Well, the world is dumpster fire, and nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good, and you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And today on the show, we have got a conversation with author Joshua Shea. This is one of my favorite conversations that we've had because it's about a topic that does not get addressed enough. And it doesn't get addressed in this particular way. Today we're talking about pornography addiction, and even more specific than that, how it relates to this current pandemic that we are in. Because I don't know if you've been paying attention, but there have been a lot of news stories about how people are starting to abuse drugs and alcohol during this time period because of the isolation and the fear and the uncertainty. And all of those things typically do cause a spike in people's dependency on escapism and substances. And there's a healthy way to do those things, and there's an unhealthy way. Now, if you're a person with an addictive streak in you, you know that you are a person who can't just have one or two drinks. You've got to have all the drinks. But what if you've got a pornography addiction? What does that look like? Do you start checking out from real human beings? Do you find yourself hurting yourself physically as you attempt to chase the high that you got from it the first time? Are you constantly craving something more and more disturbing? Because, should I even say disturbing? See, that right there is part of the conversation. Because frankly, I don't know if this is something we know enough about. We're in the age of the internet, and that has changed everything, including the way that we consume pornography. It's no longer the back room of the video store. It is now in your pocket. It is at your fingertips, and it is in the hands of your children. So what do we do? Because we're not going to ban the stuff, and frankly, we really shouldn't. It really needs to be a conversation. We need to be able to have conversations with each other and with our children like they're human beings. Like, sex is a thing people do. And sometimes it comes out in playful forms, sometimes it comes out in aggressive forms or fantasy or things like that. And as long as there is consent and there are boundaries, there's nothing wrong with that. And so this conversation does not get into the idea of trying to ban pornography or the evils of pornography. No. This episode gets into the misuse of pornography and the way that can damage your sexuality, the way that it can damage you as a person if you abuse it and if you abuse yourself. So we're going to try to get some answers on this, and you can get his book, Porn and the Pandemic, How 3 Months in 2020 Changed Everything. There are links in the feed below, so please go check that out. It's a pretty quick read, it's an easy read, and it's entertaining. It's got some different viewpoints and some different people in there telling their stories, and I really found it a pretty fascinating read. And as a matter of fact, this coming Wednesday, I'll be releasing an extra episode with a special guest who, if you follow the show and you subscribe, you'll get that. You'll get that episode. And it's going to be sort of another look at this topic from a hands-on perspective. But that's for Wednesday. For now, let's talk to Joshua Shea. So, first thing, hi, how are you doing this morning, Joshua?
I am doing quite well. How are you? Mm. Oh, your own branded mug. That's,
oh yeah,
that's an impressive flex early on.
Gotta keep it. Gotta keep it all branded.
Yeah, that's good.
There's something I find quite wonderful about just your standard ceramic coffee mug. That standard 10-ounce shape. There's something very soothing about that for me. I used to play in a kind of a punk rock band that played all over the country for a while, and it was weird because I was like the one guy in the band that didn't drink or anything, just and it wasn't because I had anything against it. It was because playing the songs was hard, and I couldn't do it. If I had anything in my system. And so it was like, I have nothing against partying a little bit after the show, but before the show, I got to have coffee. And there was just something really wonderful, especially when you're traveling to different places. I had this ceramic mug that I just took with me on the road. And when we would get coffee or something like that from a McDonald's or whatever, I would pour it into my mug and drink it, you know, in the back of the van like I'm in my living room. It was like my one comfort.
So you were the 65-year-old guy on the road with them.
Yeah, exactly. Just black coffee and reading the newspaper and muttering to myself.
So you were the Reuben Kincaid, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I think, I don't know if they would be that diplomatic about it even, but tell me a little bit about you. Where do you hail from?
I was born in Lewiston, Maine, which is about 30 miles north and 30 miles south of both Portland and Augusta, which are often, often the only two cities of reference anybody has when it comes to Maine. So I'm smack dab between the two of them. While I come from the second largest population base in Maine, because we have two cities right here, Lewiston, where I was born, and Auburn, where I actually now live. That's about 75,000-80,000 people between the two cities. Nobody's heard of them. And the fact that 75,000 people is the second largest population area shows you just how, you know, rural Maine truly is. I think it's something like 75% of the population lives in the southernmost 100 miles.
Oh, all right.
Despite the fact that the state is something like 550 miles long, if you actually measure it, Maine is the size of New England all put together. And people don't often realize how large it is, but everybody, for the most part, lives in the south or the south central part where I'm from.
Well, and Maine is a very interesting state because it's got a it's almost got its own climate compared to a lot of other places on the East Coast. It's kind of set apart. It's kind of it's kind of diverse. There's a much more diverse population than you would expect the last time I was down that way.
Yeah, while we technically are like 49th or 50th whitest state in the nation, there is a heck of a lot more diversity than there ever was when I was growing up.
Yeah. I've seen the change just in the past, you know, few years because I remember rolling through there years ago. Yeah.
It's a good thing, but it's causing, much like in the rest of this country, it's causing some cultural upheavals that, really pit people on other sides.
Yeah.
I've seen more racism in Maine in my last 10 years than I saw in my first, 34 years.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know if it's just that people feel emboldened by, who's in power now to be their racist selves, or if people, if we just never had the diversity, so I didn't recognize what was actually in these people's hearts,
yeah,
or what was going on. But it does strike me that I think, ironically, my kids grew up in a much more outwardly racist Maine than I ever did.
Weird. Yeah. If you think about it, that's strange, isn't it?
Yeah. And it should be, you know, while things, I think most people would say things slowly get better over time, here in Maine, you know, it's probably, when you're talking, you know, civil rights and acceptance, probably about 1943 right now.
Well, you know, you're moving your way up.
It's, yeah, we'll get there eventually.
So tell me a little bit about, because I think I can peg just about where your childhood was by your age. So you grew up primarily in a world where the internet was just starting to come into prominence.
I got on the internet in 1993, which was my senior year of high school.
Yeah.
First got onto bulletin board systems, which you basically dialed somebody else who created a network of themselves. And if you ever saw one of these bulletin board service providers, they just had like 12 modems lined up in a row, and each one had a different phone number. And this was before you had, you know, web browsers. There mm-hmm. was the internet, but there was no World Wide Web.
Yeah.
So, you know, we weren't even on to Netscape Navigator or any of that fun stuff yet. So I can say I was actually the first person I knew of my, you know, kind of mainstream, you know, real world friends who had an email address. I had to make friends online because my real friends didn't have any. But I would say that my formative years, or my most formative years, I grew up without the internet. Once 93, 94 hit, right before I attempted to go to college, you know, I went to college and nobody had email addresses there yet. It wasn't until the end of the freshman year that we actually got them. So there was this giant sea change in technology in the world happening right at that point, 93, 94. I think I was one of the first 150,000 people on America Online.
Yeah.
When you get the CDs in the mail or in the magazines.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was a little bit ahead on internet going into it that way. It definitely shaped my 20s and my early 20s. And I worked after I worked at a traditional consumer newspaper for about 6 years. When I was 24, I think I went to work for a high-tech trade publication that covered Northern New England's tech sector. So I got to see the dot-com boom happen up here, and I got to see the bust happen 2-3 years later too. When everybody was talking about how the new economy was coming and the internet would take over, you know, back then it didn't really happen yet, because all the people who were going to make the internet their life were only 11 years old at that point.
Right.
So we had to wait another 15 years till it became everywhere, but that's where we ended up here today. I hate to think between my phone and the computer just how many hours of my day I am actually wired into the internet. It's scary, probably, if you look at it from a dystopian 1960s sci-fi sort of way.
Well, that's all of us now. I mean, yeah. my 70-year-old parents have smartphones. And if you would have asked me if they would have had smartphones in their 70s when they were in their 50s, I would have said, no way. It's become so pervasive. And on the one hand, it's this large boon that has delivered the ability to have any information you're looking for instantly delivered to you. If you're able to navigate,
because there
is a lot of information out there. And sometimes the right information is not the easiest to find, but there is a lot of information, a wealth of information. And there's also a lot of harm that can be done that we still don't quite have any numbers on. And I don't think we're even going to start seeing scientific papers on this for another 10 years. We're just starting to sort of scratch the surface on a kind of the harm this technology can do. I almost feel like I almost feel like whoever the Oppenheimer of the internet is,
yeah,
is just going to be, you know, trying to make amends at some point, because this is an atomic, seismic shift in the way we live our lives. Everything is kind of tied around the idea of being able to connect to the rest of the world, which should be a net good. And I feel right. like it can be a net good. But there is all of this other stuff out there, which kind of leads us to the topic that you are intimately familiar with. And tell me a little bit about your introduction to internet pornography.
Well, I mean, internet pornography was just the next step.
Yeah. Of course it was.
It was one of those. Yeah. I was first shown pornography when I was 11 or 12 years old from an older cousin, some Penthouse or Hustler magazines. Mm-hmm. I was hooked that day.
Yeah.
It was, and I don't think it had anything to do with the naked people on the page or what they were doing. It was just something immediately washed over me as an 11 or 12 year old kid that felt, oh my goodness, I have just found something that immediately makes me feel better.
Yeah.
Immediately, I'm someplace else. You know, I don't even know if I was processing what I was looking at entirely, but it just it clicked immediately. You know, I knew I was. I look and look back now and say, I know I was addicted on day one.
Yeah.
Much like 2-3 years later, when I was, you know, 13, 14 years old, I got drunk at a wedding for the first time, and that's the only time I've ever felt that same first thing again. Where right. it's like, oh my goodness, this is why people do this.
Yeah.
I feel so much better. I don't feel like who I think I am. I don't feel, you know, like this bundle of nerves that doesn't belong here and is, you know, BSing his way through life.
Yeah.
And even at 14, you know, I had the, you know, mentality of a 55-year-old guy. But that's the way. And so, despite the fact I was popular in high school, that I've always been an overachiever, I have also really, from the word go, almost been a complete porn addict and complete alcoholic. On days that I wasn't doing anything after school, I was 15 years old, you know, I was already into gaslighting. I gaslit the people at the video store into thinking I was 18 with ever seeing a license so I could rent dirty movies from them. And almost every day I rode my bike. I'd rent 2 porno movies. Then I'd ride my bike to a convenience store that was independently owned, and they didn't care what they sold you. So I would always buy 2 or 3 beers and put the movies and the beers into my backpack, ride home before my parents got home from work. I'd watch one movie and drink one of the beers. And then after everybody went to bed at night, I'd drink the other beer and watch the other movie. And that's how I did things. And I was able to maintain a pretty normal life.
As I
got into my 20s, I didn't stick with school, but I did get good jobs in journalism that usually you need a degree for. So I was very lucky there. And I was able to kind of climb my way up the professional ladder while maintaining these addictions, you know, behind the scenes. I had an active social life. I had an active dating life. You know, I met my future wife when I was 26, and everything was fine. When things were going well for me, I didn't drink and utilize porn nearly as much. And when things were going poorly, when money was tight, when there was a lot more stress, these were my two go-tos to
escape
myself and make me feel better. And that was kind of the way things had been. And, you know, the movies begat the internet porn. And in the early days, it was a still photo on a screen. And then it became the animated GIFs where you got 3 seconds of movement. Started getting DVD-ROMs. And then when the internet really hit with some you know, bandwidth, you started getting some of the chat rooms and some of the video clips, and that's when things really exploded. That's when, you know, the porn hubs of the world started to incorporate and figure out just how this tool could be used.
It's a far cry from the brassiere section of the Sears catalog.
Well, that's it. I mean, I posted something on my website the other day where I said, you know, do me a favor, just go and do something for 10 minutes. Set the timer on your clock. Go get yourself something to drink or eat. Go watch TV for 10 minutes. Go check your email. And then come back here and scroll down to the bottom of my screen. And at the bottom of the screen, I wrote, in this 10 minutes, you know, there is a child on the internet who has seen more hardcore pornography than your parents or grandparents ever had access to in their entire lives.
Yes.
And that's the thing. I had lunch a couple days ago with a good friend who I worked with at the high-tech newspaper back 20, 22 years ago. And he said, and he knows all the work I'm doing now that I've written several books about porn addiction. He said, you know, I remember you bringing this up once and I never thought of it. He said, you asked what was the effect of the internet going to be on kids growing up who didn't have to sneak around and find porn. And he said, I just thought you were just throwing that out there. I remember you asking that one time, and it's a question I've gone back to a few times. And I said, you know, the reason I asked it was because I was hiding a porn addiction at the time. And I knew that the effort I had to go to get porn, and now with everybody having a computer, it's right there in front of you. And then, you know, the computer became the laptop, and then the laptop became the iPhone. So now we equip every 11-year-old with the greatest porn computer ever created.
Right.
And we're now seeing, in my latest book, which is called Porn in the Pandemic, we are now seeing and now understanding the fallout of a generation being raised with absolutely no precautions or no filters or no – and not just that, but no education and no advice on how to navigate unfettered visual sexuality. I mean,
yes.
If you know, it was a big deal to see a guy with two girls on the pages of a magazine when I was 16 years old, and now you can get four girls, three guys, you know, two midgets, a llama.
Oh yeah.
And people throwing tater tots at them the whole time. You know, whatever you can imagine, you will find on there. And you're now seeing the first statistics are coming out. While we're still understanding the brain chemistry behind porn addiction, statistics are coming out. And to me, the scariest one out there is a group called the Barna Group out of Texas. Did a study a few years ago and found out that 32% of men between 18 and 30 believe that they either have a problem with or have are fully addicted to pornography.
Yeah.
So that's one out of three men between 18 and 30 who is addicted or thinks they're addicted to pornography. Now, what happens if they don't get help before 40 or before 50 or before 60? And then you look at statistics which are exploding now for non-white, non-straight men. Because porn was always a white straight guy thing. Now that it's cheap to produce, now that it's cheap to distribute, there is porn specifically targeted towards women. There's porn specifically targeted towards the black community or the Latino community. It is now so hyper-focused that you're seeing all these groups before that didn't have the high numbers of porn addiction that straight white males had. They're all starting to rise now.
Yeah.
So that's you're going to see continual rising in those previously underserved communities. And if we don't start doing something about this, and you know, we can talk about what we need to do, because I don't think it's that big a deal. I'm not for banning porn or anything, you know, that kind of crazy.
Right.
That doesn't work.
Yeah. What would that serve?
Based on prohibition, it just didn't work. But we need to bring an educational component to it, and we need people to understand that this is not completely harmless in many situations.
Yeah.
If you don't understand what you're getting into, it can cause harm. You know, the people in the 1940s who started smoking cigarettes and weren't told until the early 60s that it could be unhealthy for you went into it not knowing what the deal was.
Right.
These are now our 25-year-old kids who are into this deal now and experiencing erectile dysfunction, experiencing all kinds of different effects of watching too much porn over the last 15 years, just discovering what the fallout is. And what we need to do in the next 10, 15 years is address what the potential health issues are and educate what the potential health issues are. Much like cigarettes, much like drinking or gambling, when you turn 18 or 21, you can do whatever you want because it's legal.
Yeah.
However, let's do that educational component so people are making smart decisions when it comes to utilizing pornography, because I ultimately believe – I know I became an alcoholic as well, and I don't know if I just hadn't been warned at that time or whatnot, but I didn't become a gambling addict. I didn't become a drug addict or a food addict or any of this stuff. I believe that a big part of this was because I was educated to the potential bad side of it.
Yeah.
And I think that had I been educated to the potential bad side of pornography, my story might have ended up differently. So that's really what I'm out there doing now, is hoping that people's stories don't end up like mine. So I'm trying to push the idea of education and the idea of knowledge behind what pornography can do to you. I'm not anti-pornography. I believe that people can utilize pornography in a way that people can drink or can gamble. I'm just not that person. And
right.
we need the people like me who may not be that person to learn it sooner than later.
Yes. You know, it's funny you mentioned that too. There's so many bits that I identify with in your story. And, you know, I was a person that had that same kind of jolt the first time that I drank. As well as the first time I had a cigarette, I found out pretty early on that I had the addictive gene. My father was an alcoholic. He made himself a sober person when I was pretty young, so I don't have a lot of memories of drunk dad. But I mean, he was pretty high functioning, severe, the kind of person who had bottles hidden in his car, you know. But I didn't really see a lot of that. But I got it, and it's in me. And it was definitely one of those things where I couldn't have just a little bit of something. I had to have all of it, had to have all of it. And I definitely felt that same jolt of electricity with pornography. Now, the thing about the education component and all of that is that I can definitely say when I discovered that that marijuana didn't kill me the way I was taught that it was going to kill me, I thought that meant, oh, drugs aren't bad. They're fine. And so, you know, there was that Just Say No campaign that I grew up with in the 80s.
Good and old it was, Nancy Reagan.
Oh, yeah. And it was, you know, just say no. Like, drugs are bad. They're all going to do the same thing. So I just kind of thought they're all sort of the same thing. And right, so when cocaine showed up and heroin showed up, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. Now, my dad was a substance abuse counselor after getting sober. And so without getting too far into it, I think I died one night. I think I OD'd and someone dropped me off. I was like 17, 16. I was dropped off on my parents' lawn for them to deal with it and just drove away. I somehow made it into the house, and I do remember my dad getting home late. He played in a band, so he got home late, and he came in to check on me, and I remember him slamming me around my room. Just furious, which was really unusual for him. He wasn't abusive or physical ever, but here I was, doped out of my mind. I think I died, and it was an interesting thing, because the next maybe 2 days later, I was grounded, of course, all of that good stuff. But he came home from work one day with a card, and he said, I thought you'd think this is interesting. And he gave it to me and he walked away. That was his typical wisdom. Say almost nothing, give a big piece of advice. And it was a card that showed the different street drugs that I was very familiar with at this point and their effect on the body, what they do, how dangerous they are, what the addiction level could be. And once I realized what they could do and what they were and how they worked, it scared the shit out of me.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to mess around with that stuff anymore, to the point where I saw that stuff and thought, oh yeah, I don't want to mess with that, because right. I have an idea of what that could do. But that was education. And I kind of started to get the same thing around pornography. Let's say only maybe, 10 years ago. And I remember that it was 10 years ago, because around 10 years ago was the time that my kid got his first smartphone. And I remember sitting in the car with the kids, because that's the place where you talk to them, because they can't leave.
Right, right, exactly.
And I remember sitting in the car and thinking, how am I going to talk to them about the fact that they're going to see porn? They're going to seek it out. They're going to find it. I know they are. So how do I talk to them about what it is they're going to see? And ultimately what I came to, and I hope it was elegant enough, I guess we'll find out. But it was, I let them know, you know, you're going to see these things. Your friends are going to share these things with you. And what I want you to know is that this is not what sex is. This is kabuki theater. This is performance.
Oh, well, I'm sure little kids understood the kabuki reference.
Weirdly, they kind of did. They sort of knew what that was. You know, because I have weird kids.
So, yeah.
But that was the conversation. It was like, this isn't real. This is an exaggeration. It's, you know, it's there for a purpose, but it's a show. And I don't want you to take that as it's not a big deal, but I want you to understand that when you're dealing with people in real life, and when you're dealing with people as you start to date and you start to want to express these things as adults, I know you're not happy hearing all of this now, but I need you to know that this is not how people behave. This is all just fake. It's like when you see people spraying machine guns into people in video games. It's not expected. It's not something that anyone really wants you to do. So just right. Keep these things in mind. And that was my elegant speech. And as I was saying this to them, I was thinking about myself and my porn habits, which had gotten kind of wildly out of control. And I've come to recognize for me that it had nothing to do with sex.
Nope.
At all.
Never does.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, first, I just want to dovetail off one thing you said. The last time that I did a presentation for any group, it was at a college back in December, before they went on break and before the whole world blew up. But it was a small group with the health center of a college, just teaching them about this. And I spoke with the woman who ran the health center afterward, and she mentioned that she does a couple support groups, and one of them is a woman's sexuality group that has mostly freshmen and sophomore in it, a couple juniors and seniors. But she said, these girls get together. She, for the last 2 or 3 years, has repeatedly been told in the group, or someone says it, and all the girls are like, yeah, that they don't want to have sex with virgin men. They don't want to take a man's virginity, because men who are 17, 18, 19 years old and have not had sex have likely watched a lot of porn. And they and they believe that the aggressiveness, that the domination, that the man taking control, and whether it's choking or hair pulling, the aggressiveness is something that women want.
Yeah.
And they have to almost retrain them immediately that this is not what sex is.
Yeah.
And once a woman retrains a guy or trains a guy, if he's a virgin, he quickly gets with the program if he wants to have sex again. But these women did not want to have sex with virgin men because they did not like the aggression that they brought to sex the first time based on the indoctrination of pornography. And we're not talking about S&M porn or some real dark web stuff.
Right.
We're talking the most mainstream porn out there
yeah.
is absolutely, you know, degrade, not necessarily just degrading, but very aggressive and very domineering male
oh,
to
yeah.
male to female. And that's the message that guys are getting. Anyway, on to your other question. I think that you handled it the right way with the kids.
Oh, good. Well, we'll find out.
I think that was absolutely right. But I think that if we're gonna, we can't be afraid to scare our kids. And yeah. we're in this society right now that says don't do that. We're in a, and I agree the fact that society says don't shame an addict, especially yeah. a porn addict. With pornography, you're talking about things like nudity. You're talking about things like sex. You're talking about those little secret itches that we all have in our head that are a little outside the norm, perhaps,
yeah.
that we don't want to talk about. That's what gets us off. And if you're a porn addict, that keeps getting further and further away from you.
Oh, yeah.
Because like any other addiction, the way that beer turns to wine turns to whiskey, you need to keep escalating because it's an addiction. So you're looking at stuff eventually that is just not who you are,
mm-hmm.
And not the vanilla stuff that, you know, mainstream people look at.
You're just chasing. Just you need chasing.
To get that, you need to get that itch scratched. And I think what we need to do is go to when these boys are 12, 13, 14. We know they're looking at porn. The average boy sees porn for the first time now at about 9 years old,
yeah.
Depending on what study you look at. However, I look at myself, and even though I was immediately drawn to porn when I was 11 or 12, saw it for the first time, I still wanted a girlfriend.
Right.
Because that's what 13-year-old boys want. They want the real thing.
Yeah.
They don't quite see porn as the surrogate or substitute yet. And I think what we need to do with these 13 and 14-year-old boys is talk about porn-induced erectile dysfunction. Because that will scare the shit out of them. And that's what we need to do. Because these boys want girlfriends. These boys in a few years want to be having sex with these girlfriends.
Mm-hmm.
And I have counseled several men, young men, who have gone through this or are dealing with it. And it's sad because it's not like complete erectile dysfunction, something is physically wrong, we need to take some pills. This is that they have fried their receptors, dopamine, oxytocin, all the fun stuff in the brain.
Oh, yeah.
They have fried these receptors to the point that they can have the most beautiful girlfriend or handsome boyfriend or whatever it is that gets them off naked in front of them, ready to go. And unless pornography is playing on the laptop or the TV behind them, they can't perform.
Yeah.
And I dealt with one guy who, the most extreme case I've heard of this, he and his girlfriend figured out that if he was in one room with his computer, she was in the other room with her computer, they could basically get on Skype or whatever it is, FaceTime, and do the cyber sex thing with each other.
Yeah.
And he was able to get an erection and get excited because his mind told him that was pornography.
Right.
So right when he's at the point that he can perform, she basically had to run in the room. And they were able to do it that way. And this kid's 22 years old and his girlfriend's,
wow.
His girlfriend's 20. Now, will he ever get better? Who knows?
Yeah.
We don't know enough about this yet to know if people get better or how it dissipates or how it gets worse. We just don't know yet. And that's one of the things that I think if we can teach these 13, 14-year-old boys, hey, guess what? Your penis may break later on if you watch too much
right.
porn. I think that might scare them to a point that we could see some dropping in the percentages.
Well, you know, and honesty matters. That's yeah. that's definitely a part of it because, you know, much like the you know, the abstinence only sex education doesn't work, I think that it's sort of the same idea here. It's like, yeah, masturbation is fine and healthy, but you can go too far. And yeah, it's not even necessarily because, again, the pornography and the masturbation are not necessarily sex. There's so many other things. It's about control of your environment. It's about de-stressing some things when you have chaos in your life. It has nothing to do with sex in most cases.
No, and it wasn't for me. And, you know, to get a little bit dark into my story here, like most porn addicts, when I was a kid, I was put in some sexual abuse, sexual inappropriate situations from the babysitter that I had when I was about, 3 to 6, 3 to 7. Mm-hmm. In this woman's house, I can look back now and recognize she was a mess. She had a lot of mental health issues. So there was a lot of mental abuse as well. I mean, more mental abuse than sexual abuse.
Yeah.
Tiny little bit of physical abuse, not too much. But if you look at the statistics that come from people like Patrick Carnes, who's kind of the godfather of porn and sex abuse study, because he was doing this long before anyone, it's somebody like 80% of sex addicts have physical abuse in their life. 90% have sexual abuse in their life.
Yeah.
97% have mental abuse in their life. And I had this going on when I was young. And basically what I learned to cope in this house with all this weird stuff going on, which was, you know, not the life I had at home. My parents were elementary school teachers who were raised strict Catholic. You know, we didn't walk around the house in our underwear, much less naked. And
right.
Then I'm at this other house where there will be rated R movies on TV, where, you know, people are walking around, you know, in their underwear, where this woman does do sexually inappropriate things, not necessarily, you know, raping children, anything like that. But I recall at one point when I was like 4 or 5 years old, she had me touch a 2 or 3 year old girl's genitals just to see how they were different than boys.
Yeah.
And that kind of stuff, which is, you know, I that's obviously abuse, but I think it's abuse on a minor level. But I think it also messes with a 4 year old's head.
Oh, absolutely.
And what I developed into, and she was like, she was the kind of person who would, if she wasn't having a good day, she could put you in a dark room for 15 minutes or 3 hours and, you know, lay on the yeah. floor for 3 hours. And I learned to compartmentalize. I learned to disassociate. I learned all kinds of tricks to play with my head to get through it. And ultimately, it was about control. And
yeah.
if you look at my life, it's nothing but one big control freak. I started my own businesses. You know, I didn't like college, so I quit 4 or 5 times because I was finally in control and I wasn't going to put up with a situation I didn't want. And ultimately, the porn comes down to control for me because, let's admit, nobody on the magazine page, nobody on the computer screen is ever going to say no.
Yeah.
They're going to say yes. You know what? If I want 2 cheerleaders today, I'll get them. If
yeah.
tomorrow I want, you know, a black woman, an Asian woman, a white woman, you know, I can get them all together because I can find that easy enough.
Yeah.
They're not going to say no. And that's really, I think, a key hole that porn filled in my life. When things were stressful, when I subconsciously was feeling out of control, I could go to the pornography and it would fill that hole where I felt like my life was out of control. I think that the alcohol numbed me.
Oh, yeah.
And made me not focus on it. I think that the pornography helped fill that void that was in my life in that moment. Of you know, not feeling control. And that's why you see people use substances in the worst of times is to fill the voids that are created by the real world.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there is a pretty vast difference between using something and abusing something. But there's a thin line. I mean, you can go over the edge before you know you've gone over the edge. And I think that that's the education component that
right.
we're talking about here. So what are some ideas about bringing yourself back from an addiction to something like this?
Well, I always tell people that I quit porn and I quit alcohol on the same day because I like a challenge. it was April 1st, 2014, and I can honestly say that I have not relapsed on either since. A lot of it has to do with the fact I'm very stubborn, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that I have some kind of OCD for statistics. And I recognize now that I'm 6.5 years into it, I would be in my early 50s if I fell down today and had to restart. Yeah. I couldn't imagine having to so it's all about the streak. And hey, that's great. It's about the streak. Whatever keeps me sober. Ultimately, what I tell people, because so many people, no matter what the substance, no matter what the behavior, tell themselves they want to quit, and they can go 5 days, or they can go 7 days, or they can go 10 days, and then they go back, and I'm so weak, I can't do this. And you have to recognize what the addiction is in your life. The addiction is about dealing with unresolved trauma. And that's something like 95% of addiction cases are always about unresolved trauma. Doesn't have to be sexual. Doesn't have to be mental. You know, you watch your parents murdered in front of you, you're going to carry some baggage with you.
Yeah.
It's unresolved trauma. And you have to, and this is the part that sucks, you have to drive your bike slowly through that trauma with the help of professionals.
Yeah.
And figure out a way to navigate that road through the trauma so you can come out on the other side. And I'll tell you, once I invested the time into doing that, once I made the commitment to go through that trauma to discover it, because you don't even realize what's deep down there when you start doing it. You only know the surface stuff, and you get down there and it's like, holy shit, I can't believe I was walking upright and this messed up.
Yeah.
Once you get to the other side of it, and you're never truly on the other side, it just stops playing such a role in your life.
Of course.
I found for myself that cravings, triggers, they dropped incredibly because I understood how I got to be the person that I am today. That's what was very important for me. And I needed to understand the connections that being that kid played later in life. I was always somebody who I had my box of being a business owner. I was on my city council locally. I had that box. I was the father and the husband in another box. And I had all these little boxes that I compartmentalized my life. And what I had to truly recognize was that was just me gaslighting myself. Everything is connected. It's a jigsaw puzzle. It's not individual boxes. Everything connects. Everything has an effect on the other stuff going on. And you need to understand that connective tissue, and you need to understand how your life organically affects other parts of your life. And when you can do that, you can get that bigger picture. And, you know, now, 6.5 years into it, I still get the occasional craving or the occasional trigger, more so for alcohol than for pornography. I think because I talk about it all day long, I'm sick of it at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But it's one of these things where deal with the unresolved trauma. I see all these poor guys going through programs like NOFAP, or they just sit and scream about being incels, and they don't, you know, they think that they can white knuckle this, and they think that there's nothing wrong with them. What's wrong is with society, and what's wrong is, you know, that porn is in their face, and that girls say no to them, and all of these things that are just, you know, excuses.
Yeah.
And if you would just sit down with a good professional, or find a good professional, or find a team of good professionals, you're going to start having some of these aha moments where you connect parts of your life and you see how things played on each other. And it is an amazing process when you start making those connections. But yeah, it sucks early on. I remembered something like 14 instances of abuse at this babysitter's home. I went into recovery just knowing that stuff had gone wrong there. But I had to actually get into it. I had to get into a lot of other stuff as well, relationships with people, my attitudes towards things, you know, everything that makes me who I am, and see how it was connected. It was a tough process, especially early on. But my God, it was so important to me, and I feel I don't know if the word is enlightened, but it's amazing when you come to understand your origin story. And, you know, I wish I would have done my 20s so differently. But I yeah. I now appreciate why I did them the way I did and why I was never going to be successful in a way that I dreamed about. You know, some people could look at me from the outside and say, you were very successful in your 20s, but I didn't feel it because I wasn't reaching my goals. I now understand why I wasn't, you know, for you being in a band touring the U.S. Well, yeah. That's something that, what, 2% of bands get to do? That's yeah. something that everybody wants to do. But I'm guessing if you're in that position and you don't have a major record contract, you're only thinking about the major record contract you don't have.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't appreciate any of it while it was happening. In fact, I actively hated a lot of it. And I look back on it now very differently, wishing I had been a very different young man. Yep. But at the same time, that young man that I was is the person that got me here, and I want to be here, and I'm glad that I'm here. I'm glad I survived me so that I could get to know me.
And that's what I tell people now. I don't even say I'm a spiritual person. I'm a bit of a spiritual person. Mm-hmm. I believe in energy, essentially, and I believe in the
– I like that.
I believe in the equalization of energy in the world. The closest thing I could say is I believe in the Force from Star Wars. I like the tenets of that.
Yeah.
But the thing is that I think that people need to believe in something a little bit bigger than them. They need to feel that they have not just a higher power, but they have a higher purpose. I look back now and I say, you know what? I worked as a journalist in newspapers for, you know, nearly 20 years. I had my own magazine here in Maine for about 5 years. Like I said, I ran for the city council and got more votes than any first-time person ever running. I was a local celebrity and, you know, my ego and my narcissist side loved that kind of stuff. But now here I look, you know, more than half a decade later, I go out in public and nobody remembers who I am or knows who I am.
Oh, yeah.
I'm this porn addiction stuff, talking to a few people at a time online. It's not like I'm writing an editorial for a newspaper that tens of thousands are reading tomorrow. I'm lucky if I get 500 people reading one of my blog entries within a month. But I feel like this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And like you said, my 20s got me to where I am now. I'm not supposed to be a magazine publisher. I'm not supposed to be a local politician. I'm supposed to be where I am right now. And right now what I'm doing is helping people understand the pratfalls of using pornography without knowing the potential repercussions. And that's what I'm supposed to be doing right now. Will I be doing this 10 years from now? Maybe, maybe not. But I like the fact that I'm on a journey that's not just about me. I like the fact I'm on a journey that is hopefully helping people. And I like the fact that I'm on a journey where I don't hate a lot of it. Like you said, my professional life was, I think, the envy of a lot of people, but I hated a lot of it.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about where we are now in this pandemic. There's a lot of things that people have no control over, and people are stuck in their houses with their automatic porno machines. Do we think that there's going to be a big problem with that? And how do we address this problem?
We are up shit creek. There's no way to say this more calmly. I mean, look, okay. Imagine that you're the CEO of an online porn company.
Yeah.
Forget any moral or any other issues you have with pornography. You're the CEO of this company, and your job is to make money. Now, here are the world conditions all of a sudden. Everybody has to stay home. They cannot go out and see other people. There will be no casual dating. The only person, if you live with a member, you know, if you live with a sexual partner, that's the only thing that you've got as a real outlet. You are going to be working from home. You're going to be in front of your computer 20 hours a day. And you are, despite all of these crazy things happening in the world, you are still the same sexual being that you were before. Hopefully a healthy sexual being, even if not healthy, and an unhealthy sexual being. We're all sexual beings, and all of a sudden, everybody is stuck getting everything that they want, essentially, from the internet. So what happens? Yeah, people turn to porn. People turn to porn in numbers they never would. And as the CEO, you got to get more people there. So you look at somebody like Pornhub. What they did was, first, they gave free access to their premium site to Spain, Italy, and France because they were the first places hit with COVID the worst.
Yeah.
A couple weeks later, when it was obvious that it was going to be everywhere, they gave free access to people around the world. And while you can look at third-party websites and see that they had a bit of a bump from their regular traffic, the place that you really saw the traffic was on their premium site. Now, it was only a fraction of the traffic they got to their regular site. But when it goes from being like the 30th most popular porn site in the U.S. to the 6th most popular porn site, when it's getting, you know, 100,000 more people visiting every day than before because it's free, you can't tell me that they did not convert a lot of those people to paid accounts. You know, Pornhub made huge money during this. And what we saw in this pandemic, which in my new book, I talked to a lot of porn addicts. There were some, it seemed like the line was, if you had been in recovery less than 2 years, you fell off the wagon during the pandemic. If you'd been in recovery for more than 2 years, you were able to stay on the wagon because you've developed a mindset and the tools that you don't need it. But what we've seen, almost a bigger story than the people using porn, is that because of everybody being at home, because of porn needed, for the first time ever, there was a demand that had never been seen before, especially for what is now happening with these cam rooms or sites like OnlyFans. What you're seeing is a whole generation of kids, you know, 18 to 25, who, where do most of them work now? They work in the service industry, in restaurants, they're bartenders. You know, they are put off work, and because of the way that their incomes are set up, they may not, depending on the state, get the income in unemployment insurance that they hoped for. So if you're buff 24-year-old guy with a good body, or, you know, a cute 21-year-old girl with a good body, and you've been raised on the internet, and porn doesn't have the stigma that it had before, well, why not launch yourself an OnlyFans page? If, you know, you're not stripping for people live, you're in control. You're doing this in your environment. You know, nobody's coming to see you. Nobody knows your real name. Well, what the heck? I'll put my junk on the internet. I'll put my boobs on the internet. And with OnlyFans, which is kind of like, I call it like the Facebook of pornography.
Yeah.
If you subscribe to OnlyFans people, you know, you are part of this wave of what's happening now. In January, OnlyFans was something like the 600th most popular website overall in the U.S. By the last time I checked in mid-May, it was something like right around 42nd, 43rd. OnlyFans gained so many viewers, so many visits, so many hits during the first 3 months of the pandemic, they equaled what Pornhub did in their early days, but took about 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
It was condensed into 3 months, and now you have this you look at the numbers that of especially young females, but there are a lot of men on there too, using OnlyFans, and I guarantee you, while you don't know who it is, you know somebody or you know somebody's kid who is flashing it all on OnlyFans.
I actually do know someone.
I think that the next question, much like I asked my friend 20 years ago, what's going to be the effect of using porn you know, completely with no barriers, what's going to be the use? What's going to happen? We now have to ask ourselves 20 years from now, what's going to be the fallout of people making their own pornography? And is there going to be a fallout? What's it going to be? Because this isn't like, you know, the one girl who posed in Playboy, you know, first. Who everybody knew. This is on your street. There's probably four women and two men making pornography today. You just don't know about it. So what happens to this hidden part of society? What happens to these people? I don't know if the whole your pictures get discovered in 25 years. What are you going to do? I don't know if that's actually – number one, that's not a good argument because it doesn't work.
Right.
And I don't know if it's going to be a big deal because – if everybody on Earth has naked pictures of themselves out there, what's the big deal?
Yeah, maybe it's not so special anymore.
I don't think it's going to be special in the aspect of seeing somebody naked, but I do wonder, will there be any of these effects like porn addiction had on this generation? Will there be any new effects that we can't even fathom right now that hit these people? What happens when we've got a generation of 20-year-olds right now turning 50 year old? What happens if all of a sudden they all start clicking and have regrets that this happened, or recognize that because they were sharing their bodies like this online, they developed some kind of intimacy disorder that doesn't pop up for 10 years. You know, we don't know what's going to happen, but I think these are the questions that we now have to ask. It's not just about what is it like to watch too much porn, you know, as a regular person. What happens when you're making too much porn as a regular person? And this is something that before the pandemic, we didn't really have to ask, but these websites, they actually had to go out and recruit women to be on site. You know, most of these sites before the pandemic, you know, as a user, you'd pay $10 and $5 would go to the model, $5 would go to the company. These companies, to compete with each other, had to bring up the commissions. So now there are a lot of people out there who are earning 80% of that $10 because the webcam site or the modeling site wants you to go with them. And, you know, one of the things that I put in my new book, which made me laugh when I saw it, but really underscores the situation, is that there was one website that actually put out a press release specifically trying to recruit laid off and furloughed McDonald's employees. That's how specific they got with trying to recruit new porn models. So while everybody is wondering, oh my God, everybody's sitting at home and watching pornography, what's going to happen? Well, guess what? There's a big percentage sitting at home making pornography for the first time. And what's going to happen there? That's the kind of question we need to ask now. We need to be proactive. You know, America especially, we are a reactive society. We are a proactive society. You can look at our COVID statistics and see we are a reactive society. You can look at how we handled the opiate crisis.
Yeah.
We are a reactive
society. It turns into, oh shit, that was a thing? Well, we got to do something about that?
Rappers have been talking about Vicodin for 30 years.
Yeah.
You can go back and watch cop shows of the late 60s and they're tracking down heroin. It's not like we didn't know this stuff was out there. It's just that we decided that heroin users, that pill poppers, they were the other side of the tracks. They were gross people. We didn't know those kinds of people in our real life.
Right.
They were the dregs of society. Well, fast forward 25 years, and almost everybody's family or friend group, you know somebody who has a problem with opiates because we were not proactive. We were reactive. And that's what's going to happen with pornography if we're not proactive. We see porn addicts. There's a stereotypical porn addict. It's a 19-year-old guy living in his mom's basement. He's never kissed a girl in real life. You know, he's got pimples and his awkward. And that's what people think the porn addict is. They can't be a porn addict, and they don't know any porn addicts because they don't know guys like this. When, you know, I went to a porn and sex rehab for 7 weeks. I met doctors and lawyers and mothers and every ethnicity and every demographic you can imagine. There is no stereotypical porn addict, just like there's no stereotypical opiate addict. And yeah. I think that you're also going to find with the deluge of make it home porn, there is no stereotypical porn producer. You're not talking about every woman having daddy issues. You're not talking about every, you know, man, not having his parents there to guide him along the way, or being secretly gay or anything like that. It is every type of person who is out there doing this now, because it's so large, but it's still underground. And this is an aspect of porn addiction we need to start talking about, or at least get on the table, is not just viewing porn addiction, but the potential for making porn addiction.
Yeah. It's almost like we've got to start doing the same thing that we did with alcohol, and just tell people, please fap responsibly.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It's silly, but it's actually kind of appropriate, because you've got to be aware that there is a potential for harm and a potential for addiction. And you have to kind of be aware that you might have some of that in you, or that, because even if you don't have a history of addiction with anything else in your life, you might not necessarily even understand what it is that's bringing you over the line with regards to porn addiction, because people don't talk about porn.
Right. And I'll tell you the truth, I did not know that porn addiction was a thing.
Yeah.
Until I didn't say to myself, well, this is the day that I'm going completely clean. I picked the day I was going clean from alcohol. I ended up going to a rehab in 2014 out in Palm Springs, California. I thought I'd be there for 28 days. I was there for 70 days, because after a week of kind of fighting it, I recognized I was absolutely the alcoholic they were talking about.
Yeah.
And I got into the program, and that was really my entry into recovery. My caseworker, the last few weeks I was there, had me meet with a guy he knew off campus who was a certified sex addiction therapist. And this guy helped me recognize that I had a porn addiction, and it predated my alcohol by a couple years. This was really the first time I was even introduced to the concept of porn addiction. I thought that my use of porn was just a poor decision based on the alcohol, not a completely addiction altogether.
Yeah. So how has your mental health been since, as far as once you started addressing these issues that kind of put this, let's say, inelegant solution in front of you, once you had to overcome that and start dealing with the things that put you there, how did you start to see improvement? Did you start to see improvement, or was that a whole separate thing?
Well, I mean, it's important to note that I also have bipolar disorder. I was diagnosed in my early 20s with that, and as part of recovery, because of the stuff that happened, you know, back at the babysitter's house, I have been diagnosed with PTSD,
yeah,
which makes a fair amount of sense. And I also have been diagnosed with a detachment disorder, which totally makes sense to me as well. Understanding this stuff helps me put my mental health into perspective. When I can kind of identify now if things are starting to go off the rails, or am I having a genuine emotion, or is this something that my mind is just doing to me? And, you know, am I worried, or do I have anxiety? Because those are two different things in my life.
Right.
And, you know, am I sad or am I depressed? Those are two different things in my life. And one of the great things was, along with cognitive behavioral therapy, I also did a bunch of dialectal behavioral therapy, and that allowed me both of those things. When you work them, and it's hard to learn to work them, but you basically take control of your mind and you make decisions. And, you know, early on you have to run through a series of questions for yourself, and, you know, you're constantly in a state of self-analysis. But, you know, over time, you kind of build muscle memory. So you don't have to ask yourself all these questions. And overall, I, you know, not only am I in a mentally healthier place, I'm in a physically healthier place, spiritual happier place. I'm overall a much happier, much more healthy person than I ever was in my addiction. I probably weighed 50 pounds more before my addiction. You know, when it was going really bad, I was showering once every 4 days. It was gross. It was nasty. You know, there was a suicide. I don't know if I'd go all the way to say attempt, but there was a few moments. One Christmas in 2013, where I was in a complete calm place because suicide made sense to me. I believe that if I would have continued on the way, it was only, you know, 5 months later that I got into recovery. I believe that if I would have continued on the way I did, I don't know if I would have driven into a house because of the drunk driving. I don't know what would have happened, but something was going to break. Something was going to give. And I would give 50-50 odds that I would not be here with you today, whether it's because I did something stupid while I was intoxicated or whether it was because I did something at my own hand. I was at the end of my rope, and thankfully I came back just in time. And now I see the way that, I don't want to say normal people, but I am closer to the way that I know you're supposed to be.
Yeah.
That there's a clarity within me that I recognize what's important. I have different priorities. I hate to see what's going on in our country with politics and with race as much as anybody else. But before, where I would spend 3 hours on Facebook or something railing about it, thinking that I'm changing the world, you know, I now recognize that I can't be silent, but that I am not the savior that everybody's looking for when it comes to spreading the truth. Just little changes like that in my attitude and in my way of looking at the world have been utterly healthy.
Well, I could talk to you about this probably all day and peel back so many layers of the onion. So maybe we'll have to have you come back next season and see where things are, because hopefully we'll have some answers on some of these questions about the pandemic and how it all worked out. But until then, thanks for coming by and talking to me today.
Yeah, no problem. And, you know, I just want to let people know that, like, my book is out there now, just released a couple weeks ago as of when you and I are recording this. It's called Porn in the Pandemic, How 3 Months in 2020 Changed Everything. And maybe I'll have to update it in 3 more months to be how 6 months changed everything. Who knows? But that's out there now. That is more of a journalistic look at what things are going on. My first book was more autobiography, if you like that, if you want to know my story. My second book was actually geared towards partners, because my wife had to go through this when I was going through it. And there's a sense of betrayal. There's a sense that everything has to change. And, you know, how much do you want to know versus do you not want to know? And I wrote a book with a therapist to give perspective on what partners, specifically females, but it can be anybody, what partners should do. I have a website where I have resources. If you think you have an addiction, you need to get some help, or you need to see somebody. It doesn't matter the addiction, because addiction doesn't end well. It ends with losing your friends and family. It ends with going bankrupt. It ends in jail. It just doesn't end well. It never does end well. It's like buying a pet. You know it's not going to end well, but what you can do is take care of it before it ends poorly. That's the only thing you can do, and I urge you to do that. I've got resources on my site. I write about recovery. I write about addiction. Plenty of stuff there if you need to get in touch with me. That website is recoveringpornaddict.com.
Nice and easy.
Yeah, thankfully, not all the good porn domains were taking when I got mine.
Well, thanks for talking to me.
I appreciate you having me on, because while I can share the story, while I can share the stats, there are still so many people who are squeamish to talk about this. And
yeah,
you know, I have a message, but you're delivering the medium. So I have to thank you very much for being part of this as well.
It was great.
All right. Thank you.
I really want to thank Josh for coming on the show and being brave and sharing this information with the world, because this is not an easy topic to talk about. So I'm very, very glad that we had this conversation. And if you think that you might be an addict, or that you have a loved one that might be an addict, or even just have some questions about it, you can go to recoveringpornaddict.com, where you can talk to Josh one-on-one, and you can get links to all of his books. He's got several books, including a brand new one about the pandemic that we're in right now. And if you want to hear the episode this Wednesday with my special guest, Mistress Lucifer, you're going to want to hit that subscribe button. But until then, don't kill yourselves out there.